And we see this, it really is part of the collapse of the American system. And the model for the collapse of the American system would be the Soviet system, because they just collapsed, basically. And we've got an expert to tell us a little bit about how this all went down and the comparisons with the USA today. Welcome to On the Edge, Dmitry Arlov.
Great to be with you, Max.
Can you describe for us what is the collapse gap?
The collapse gap is a rhetorical device I use to compare the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of the structure of it and how resilient it turned out to be in the face of collapse. And the collapse gap is the gap between how resilient the Soviet system turned out to be post-collapse and how resilient the American system is turning out to be now that it is collapsing.
Okay, now if this is the collapse, where are the soup lines like we saw in the Great Depression?
They are not the soup lines, they're the empty pantries, the public places where they hand out food. They're chronically running short. They are the record number of people on food stamps right now, and also the number of malnourished people who are not very plainly visible because of the structure of American society, but they're certainly there.
Okay, now in America, the mainstream media doesn't report on the people at the food pantries. Is this similar to what happened in the USSR?
Well, yes. You couldn't really read about the troubles in the Soviet Union by reading Pravda, no more than you can see about the troubles in the United States by watching CNN.
So American media is pretty much analogous to Pravda at this point.
Well, I wouldn't say analogous, but certainly it is there to bolster the status quo, not to dismantle it.
Okay, now former IMF economist Simon Johnson, when writing on the ongoing crisis, he saw similarities to the oligarchy in Russia. Do you see any similarities between the financial oligarchy today in America and the oligarchy in Russia?
Well, yes, the period right before Gorbachev and under Gorbachev as well saw the dismantling of the Soviet system, and it went under the guise of privatization, but really it was just handing pieces off to your friends. We have something similar going on in the United States now, where basically the government prints money, hands it out to their banker friends, the banker friends recycle it as campaign contributions, you know, that can perpetuate the system for a little while longer.
Right. So in the USSR, it was an industrial oligarchy. In America, it's a financial oligarchy, I would say.
Well, yes, there was still some industry in the Soviet Union left, whereas there's very little of it in the United States.
Okay. Now, you talk about de-financialization and de-globalization. What is this?
Well, these are just very long words as far as I'm concerned, but basically people have to get used to the idea of having to survive without recourse to credit or a lot of money, without their savings, without retirement, without all of these trappings of a financial system that is collapsing around them. And deglobalization basically means that they have to somehow figure out how to survive without imports, which are critical to a lot of Western economies.
Okay, if there's definancialization going on, how come the banks are still making so much money?
Well, it's fake money. I mean, it's just digits inside a computer. There's really, you can't really equate money in banks to wealth of the society.
Right, because money is not wealth. You do have a siphoning off of these medium of exchange units, U.S. dollars, that are being tilted into an oligarchy class, but the overall majority of the population is being forced onto what I would call reservations. Like the Americans, remember when they conquered the West, they put all the indigenous population onto reservations. Now it seems like history is repeating itself. The American oligarchs on Wall Street are pushing the average American onto financial ghettos and tent cities, but of course they don't report on it. So I guess that's where the similarity comes in.
Money is printed, handed out to bankers. Bankers pay themselves bonuses. They use those bonuses to pay slip fees on their mega yachts. And then everybody else, eats, noodles out of a tin can.
Let's talk about definancialization a little bit more, how it looks on the ground, the day-to-day experience of how this will look.
It'll look different to all sorts of different people. The overall framework of society tends to devolve to a very local level, where everybody starts thinking in terms of what sorts of things they have direct access to. So it's really hard to generalize. It's easier to see the systemic problems that will prevent the system from working, it's much harder to see what sorts of adaptations people will come up with.
Okay, so Dmitry Orlov, you wrote an essay on the web, which is widely quoted, widely distributed, The Collapse Gap. In that essay, you enumerate several things that we look at to see how this collapse in the U.S. and the USSR are really, point for point, almost exactly the same. And for the points that we missed, can you just fill in some of those gaps into the Collapse Gap essay?
Basically, a touch of cold turkey when it comes to oil. In the Soviet Union, that was basically the shock of having production peak and start to decline, having reached technological and geological, to some extent, levels and limits. And in the United States, there was a gigantic spike in oil prices that basically crashed the economy. So oil tends to be the Achilles heel of industrial economies, and when that gets disrupted, bad things start happening. And then the next thing that happens is all of the rosy projections in terms of infinite growth turn out to be false, and the financial house of cards starts to collapse, which happened in the Soviet Union. It was unable to take on debt at the same rate, and basically at that point the political class decided to start dismantling it. Same thing is happening in the United States. Nobody can project very far into the future as far as the ability of the United States to go deeper and deeper into debt at an ever-accelerating rate. So those are gigantic similarities. Another one is having a military that is incapable of victory and is bogged down fighting Muslim insurgents in places like Afghanistan, in fact, Afghanistan specifically. And last but not least, having an almost completely functionally defunct political system, political class that is really cut off from the people that's supposed to represent or govern, which was the case in the Soviet Union. So we had the nomenklatura, the Communist Party elite, and here we have the Capitalist Party elite, I like to call them, the Democrats/Republican Party.
Well, we have Goldman Sachs in the U.S., so, they have, should wear a little GS on their lapel and the hammer and sickle, but in this case it would be derivatives and collateralized debt obligations. But now in your essay, Dmitry Orlov, you talk about really the interesting point that you make is how when the Soviets collapsed, it was like falling out of a one-story building, but in the U.S. it's like falling out of a 20-story building. Because in the Soviet Union, for example, the state owned the transportation and a lot of the housing, so these things were actually covered, whereas in the U.S. these things are not covered. Can you speak on that a little bit?
The economy is all there is in the United States. In the Soviet Union, the economy as such was basically a small part of the living arrangement. Basically, people owned in public housing, all of them. They used public transportation, all of them. All of this stuff was fueled by basically a command and control system that produced raw materials, processed them, and delivered them according to a schedule. There was no market system to basically start profiteering from shortages and start gouging people wherever possible. And so it just continued working like that. Public sector employment was prevalent, so public enterprises have no way of going bankrupt. They can't liquidate very well, so they continue a sort of zombie existence for a while. And that makes for a very gradual transition with very little homelessness. People don't get stranded in places because they can't afford to drive their cars anymore, things like that. So that made the Soviet experience much better than it is turning out to be in the United States.
Okay, so finally, you do talk a little bit about some of the upsides to the collapse gap, and can you speak on that somewhat?
For lovers of wildlife, one of the things that happens after a collapse is the smog is gone, the pollution is much less, the amount of trash being produced is tiny, relative to what was there before, and so wildlife rebounds, and the natural realm starts to take over. Parking lots start to spontaneously depave themselves and become a wilderness again, things like that. So people who like the natural realm more than the human built-up realm, have something to look to. And then another way to look at it is that there isn't really a lot that's good about the system that we have in place now. We know how fast it's destroying the planet, destroying the climate system, destroying nature. And so putting a stop to it is not such a bad thing at all.
Right. Well, as I've often said, the economy is a subset of the ecology, not the other way around. And in the end, the ecology will have the last word on how the economy goes about doing the future. Anyway, okay, Dmitry Orlov, thanks so much for being on The Edge. I hope to check back with you again soon. Do you have another major essay in the works? I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Well, not at the moment, but I might come up with something sooner or later.